Father in the heavens, we appeal to you in the name and through the blood of Yahshua the Messiah. We are his disciples, and in that authority we approach you, Father, beseeching you for heavenly protection and guidance. We confess that we overcome the enemy by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of the witness we speak. We ask you, Father, please to bind the enemy and all his kingdom. Command that they have no influence over the presentation here and this material. We ask that this protection be extended to all those who hear these words or contemplate the material through any means. Father in the heavens, we pray that there be only good as a result of this presentation, only good and no evil. Cause every good word to take root and bear fruit, and cause every erroneous word to evaporate. Committing this now into your hands, we pray. Hallelujah. Amen. You can be seated now. Brothers, sisters, friends, my name is Michael Bannock from Fulton, Missouri. Every blessing of Yahshua be upon you. The title of my remarks is A Short Course in Spiritual Realities. You've heard of the milk of the word. You've heard of the meat of the word. Today is beef jerky. This is going to be very hard for some of you to receive. So I want you to gird up the loins of your spirit and get ready. Now, you'll need to know your Bible to follow this. We'll cite the Bible here and there, but I'll be citing Bible passages that are well known. It is common in our culture for people to say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. I've asked this question around of friends of mine. I didn't mean to embarrass you. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I've asked people, what's the difference between being spiritual and being religious? In this worldly perspective has taken root. It is common for people to think, I don't need religion, I'm spiritual. This common expression is a recipe for eternal death. And I'm about to straighten this thing out for you. I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. Truth is, you're already spiritual. Just as your physical, natural life is governed by Yah's law, so too must be your spiritual life. Yah's laws tell you how to govern your physical, natural, visible life. His laws tell you also how to govern your spiritual life. You need Yahweh's original religion to govern your spiritual life. In this happy talk in the culture, oh, I'm spiritual, this is just a recipe for overthrowing his laws. If I come up here and say, I want to be spiritual, that would be like me coming up here and saying, I have flesh. It'd be like me wanting to come up here and say, I want to have flesh, I want to have blood, I want to have bone. I already have these things. You already have a spirit. You can't get around it. You're already spiritual. And Yahweh has laws about governing that too, and how to assess that, and what to make of it. One thing I must emphasize is the spiritual world is just as real as the physical, natural, and visible life that you have now. The question is, how do you govern it? Do you just roll with it? I'm going to prove to you now from Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1 and 2, that the spiritual world that seems so elusive, so distant, it is real, it's tangible, it's physical. In Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah gets a glimpse of the throne room of heaven. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw Yahweh sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above it stood the seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. Think about it. With two wings he flew. That means there's an atmosphere up there. And those wings have to be solid hard to push against that atmosphere so he can fly. And later in his vision, he says, oh my goodness, I've seen Yahweh and I'm a man of unclean lips. And one of these creatures flew to a cauldron of barbecue pit of some kind with coals, and he put it on his lips. But he flew around there. The spiritual world is very real. And when angels visit us, by the way, this is not an angel. This is a spiritual creature. Angels, messengers, when they visit us, they don't have wings. They look like people. They always look like people. This is proof that the spiritual realm is real. The seraphs have wings. Why? Because that's how they get around. Casper the Friendly Ghost cartoons and Hollywood sources know nothing about the spiritual world. But we're tricked by these things. We see images of Casper in the cartoons, and you kind of see through him and you kind of don't. You know, in some of these graphics computer programs, you can adjust the opacity of an element on a picture. How much can you see through it? But our perceptions of the spiritual world are kind of warped compared to what it really is like. Often in the course of my life, I've heard people say, when you have a body like Yahshua, you can walk through walls like he did. I've heard that in the course of my life. That's baloney. There's not a verse in the Bible that says he walked through walls. He simply appeared. The truth is, the spiritual realm includes everything, including our world. The spiritual realm is everything. I know we like to think the spiritual world is out there, maybe a million miles away. It's all over. And we in the physical world are just a subset of that. Like if I held up one of these pieces of paper here, this piece of paper only operates in two dimensions, up and down, left and right. But there's more dimensions beyond that, forward and backward. But the paper only exists in two dimensions. That's kind of how our existence is. We're like this piece of paper floating in three-dimensional space and time. Everything else added to that is the true spiritual realm. Everything. It's real. It's solid. When angels come to visit us, they eat just like Yahshua did. Now I'm going to talk about spiritual experiences. Because your spiritual side is real. Unfortunately, the cultural's got some people thinking that just because it's spiritual, it's perfect, it's right, it's true, it's pure. Well, that's baloney, as you'll find out. Let's start with your physical life. Your physical senses put out feelers. You touch things, you smell things, you taste things. And sometimes you're wrong about things, aren't you? Your physical senses are often wrong. Sometimes you have optical illusions. Sometimes you misread something. Sometimes your extremities get numb. I've had my arms and legs go numb on me since I was a kid. Can I trust what I feel when my limbs are numb? Of course not. Our physical senses and the processing of that in our mind is prone to error. The same is true of your spiritual side. As you travel through this life, your spirit picks up on spiritual stimulus. Your spiritual senses and your ability to process information are also prone to error. And this is where we part company with the pagans. Because in the pagan world, any spiritual experience is somehow truth. And they go chase it and they follow it. They build doctrines around it. But in fact, your spiritual side, being subject to error, often can be misled. Our culture sends the message that spiritual is correct in some infallible way. The truth is sometimes you're right and sometimes you're wrong. Merely having spiritual sensitivity does not make you right. You can be very sensitive spiritually. Some people are more than others. It's a part of your makeup. Now, women are endowed with greater spiritual sensitivity. Sometimes we call this feminine intuition. I can see that by observation and research, but does that make them infallible? No, these poor girls simply have more information to sort through, and often they get it wrong. Men, you might notice that girls sometimes think in several compartments at once, because in their spirit, they're processing more information. Doesn't make them necessarily right. I hate to be the bearer of this news. By the way, men have things that on one hand are strengths, but also weaknesses too. But since we're talking about spiritual realities, a woman's intuition makes her vulnerable as much as it makes her strong. Ladies, that too must come under Yahweh's laws. You got to control your spirit according to Yahweh's laws, as we'll see in a bit. The Torah, interestingly, the Torah provides relief for men being visited with, quote, a spirit of jealousy. And that's explicitly what the Bible says. Man is jealous about his wife. He can take a trip down to Jerusalem, go to the tabernacle, and there's a ritual involving the priest. A woman drinks a bowl of dirty water. I'm not going to get into the details. But her follow-on medical condition is proof or disproof of her faithfulness. But we have no such ritual for women having jealousy. And I often wonder about that. A man can be delivered from a spirit of jealousy through this ritual. There's no such ritual from women. Does that mean they're always right? Come on, guys. Have you seen how women get jealous sometimes over absolutely nothing? It's kind of legendary how women can get jealous over nothing. And we have to work real hard to convince them that we've been faithful or our hearts have not drifted. But this is, on one hand, a strength to be spiritually sensitive, but it's also a vulnerability. Your spirit is not infallible, and even your most deeply held beliefs and feelings must be verified. If I'm not given the grace to finish this presentation, that last line means a lot. Your feelings, your spiritual experiences, must be verified. The fact is, you don't have to be in the right religion to have a spiritual experience. Here are some examples of spiritual experiences. Hunches, premonitions, aha moments. You're reading the scriptures and you see some things come together. You go, aha, I think I see something come together. You know, a lot of division in the household of faith starts with someone reading the Bible. They go, aha, and they think they saw something new. How about dreams? That's a spiritual experience. Suspicion. Intense feelings like love and jealousy. Now, there's more to come. I remember as a kid, I made the terrible mistake of giving my heart to the Chicago Cubs. And I remember the sports announcer saying, Leo DeRocher is famous as a hunch manager. A manager who manages the ball team by hunches. And this is supposed to be like, ooh, real powerful. Like, ooh, we got like angels in the outfield. However, his hunches didn't do the Chicago Cubs any good. And fans like me have many years of heartbreaks to point to. Every one of these things is fallible. Hunches, premonitions, aha moments. We've had cases where these things anticipate the future, they anticipate reality, and we've all had cases where they fall short. Just like your physical senses. Let's do a case study. Some of this is going to be hard. Some of you may be troubled by this. I know there's people listening who come from diverse backgrounds, but you know it's time to get real with Yahweh. There's a bunch of knuckleheads up in Kansas City. They call themselves the Kansas City Prophets. One report says that they are correct two-thirds of the time, but they're allowed to continue. Another report from one of their leaders, Mike Bickle, he complained that they're right only 40% to 70% of the time. If I was pastor up there, I'd kick him right out. Claiming to be prophets of Yahweh? Claiming to hear his voice? And dishing out false prophecies? There's a famous magician called the Amazing Randy. He's retired now, and he's a skeptic of the supernatural. He once published the rules for popular psychics, you know, like barroom psychics, the psychics who show up in the magazines. Here's two rules he had found for them. One, if you're a psychic and you make an accurate prediction, then you claim the Almighty showed that to you. He told me. He connected with me. But if your prediction is wrong, you apologize that you failed to pick up the signals properly. See, this way you're always covered. If I'm correct, he showed me. If I'm wrong, oh, I'm only human. Let's do another case study. I've been very careful in my presentation of these case studies. In the Chicago Fellowship, we had a visitor from far away. I'll call him Brother F, a little sign language there. And we had a local brother, Brother L. A very faithful, beloved brother. This faraway brother would come once in a while, and he claimed to have a prophetic gift. Funny, but so often when he came, he brought arguments with him. But Brother F, the faraway visitor, went to Brother L and said, I had a dream. I had a dream. One of your brothers died. Now, he was talking about his brother in Adam. And Brother L said, well, which one? And Brother F identified which of the brothers was going to die. Well, in the passage of time, one of his brothers did die, but it was the wrong one. It was a different brother. Now, I got on the phone with this guy because he insisted he was a prophet. I said, you're no prophet. You predicted the wrong brother would die. And here's what he said. He says, oh, I'm a prophet, all right. I just got to get better at picking up the signals. Okay? So now he's no better than the cheap barroom psychics of Chicago. Got to pick up the signals. His spirit went out there and picked up information about the pending passage of one of the local guys' kin. But because his spirit is subject to error, misinterpreting, misreading, he was partially right and partially wrong. Well, I wouldn't want a guy like that guiding the assembly, that's for sure. We have all played this game, I think. In the course of my life, I have said that if my hunch or my premonition proves correct, I figure, the Almighty told me that. But if my anticipation is wrong, I'll shrug my shoulders and say, well, I'm only human. Do you play that game? If something you expect comes along, do you tell people, I knew that would happen? But do you keep mum when your anticipations prove to be untrue? It's just an example of your spirit going out there and picking stuff up. Sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. Is this any basis for doctrinal decisions, though? Here was a hunch that Moses had. Before he died, he anticipated that Israel would fall away. I'm going to read only the part that I've underlined here from Deuteronomy 31, verse 27 and 29. For I know that after my death you will utterly corrupt yourselves. He expected Israel to slide as soon as he died. But the Bible history shows that Joshua and the elders that lived after him kept things going. Now Moses didn't prophesy here. He didn't say, thus saith Yahweh. He was speaking from his own suspicions. Parents do that to their kids sometimes. I know what you're going to do. You're going to borrow the keys to the car and you're going to bring it back dirty. It's a reasonable expectation based on past experience. But you cannot use hunches, suspicions, premonitions, things that you're picking up in your spirit, you can't use that as a basis for doctrine or establishing what Yahweh has to say. Some of these case studies are difficult. Let's get something straight, though. Yahweh invites us to compare courtship, betrothal, and marriage to the plan of salvation. He put that in there. And amazingly, a lot of the things that you see going on in courtship, betrothal, and marriage happens in this plan of salvation as well. Yeah, some of this material will overlap what you heard at the feast a few years ago. Some of it is new. But we're going to look at cases where people had spiritual experiences before getting married. We're going to build a bridge to understanding spiritual realities in Yahweh's true religion. Lots of people have given me testimony of how they met and immediately felt a connection. It's just between themselves. It's as though Yahweh revealed to them, I emphasize that, revealed to them who their mate would be. They get together and they have a great life. And it's probably going to happen after this presentation. People are going to come to me and say, I know, I just know the Almighty Father wanted me to marry this person. And some have purposed to make a doctrine out of that experience. As though they want me to follow their footsteps in finding a mate. Just pray he'll bring the right one to you. Well, if you've won in the lottery of love and you've successfully found a life partner, you'll be tempted to instruct others on what worked for you. We know Satan can bring bad relationships together. He can bring people together and make it an irresistible temptation, it seems. So it stands to reason that Yahweh would bring people together too. I accept that. Divine appointments. Maybe some people out there praying fervently for a life partner. And Yahweh sets up these appointments. But question, does he demand that they get married? So many people have told me, I know it was his will that I marry that person. Let's think about that. If they don't marry that person, have they sinned? In the Isaac and Rebecca story, clearly a match made in heaven, Rebecca had the right of refusal. If the Almighty really wants me to marry one person and I decline, have I ruined my life? Have I ruined her life? Have we ruined the lives of others we might alternately marry? I don't think he operates like that. And I have to tell you guys something. Those of you who are married, if you're at odds with your wife for anything, Probably the worst thing you could tell her is, you know, the Almighty wants us together. You know, he wants us to make up. You're better off going to your lady and telling her and reminding her how important she is to you and how much you need her. And you can't imagine life without her. It would be great if people would grow up and make these decisions with a combination of rational thought and prayer instead of laying everything at the feet of the Almighty. I know many of you have a testimony. Oh, I asked for a sign, I cast a fleece, and so on. When it really comes down to it, your sacred duty in marriage is to love, honor, and cherish each other. A more reasonable case would be the brother down in the South who fasted and prayed when he anticipated marriage to a lovely lady. And in his fastings and prayers, in his spirit, Yahweh told him, if you want to get married, that's a good match, leaving it as a matter of choice. I'd hate to go to a lady and say, he told me I got to marry you. I don't see that. So far in these cases, though, things have gone smoothly. I'm talking about cases where people feel a strong conviction in their spirit to come together. I think a lot of these situations are just premonitions. I think a lot of these cases are just their spirits mingling in a very pleasurable way, and they really get along. But what about those cases where people experience something profound in their spirit and the partner they are drawn to is a bad choice? What theology do you have for them? Really, if you're going to come to me later or you meet me at the feast, say, Brother Mike, I know for sure I was supposed to marry this person. What theology do you have for those who followed that feeling and they inherited a disaster? What do you have for them? I've collected many stories and testimonies like this. Good ones and bad ones. Two theaters of activity. A lot of spiritual promptings and energy. Get together, everything fine. Other cases, just like it, everything falls apart. What theology do you have for that? Now, I think I have an answer, but I'd like you to stick with me. One emphatic lady I knew, she said, I know it was his will for me to marry this guy. 1 year later, she divorced him. And what's odd, 1 year before that conversation, she was already laying the groundwork for destroying her marriage. But she was emphatic. The Almighty told me to marry this guy. Then there was the youth who wouldn't budge. A young man I know, he was just adamant. The Almighty, notice I don't use the holy name a lot here because this is kind of heavy stuff. He insisted the Almighty wanted him to marry a certain girl. His parents begged him, don't do it. There's problems there. She's a crazy lady. Her parents are crazy. You don't want to get mixed up in that. Boy, within weeks after, he ran off and married her. Within weeks, pick your terminology. It imploded. It exploded. A million smithereens. His life was ruined. But he was insistent. The Almighty told me to marry her. What's funny is his older brother had something similar happen a few years prior. Remember one sister, I had this habit decades ago of just before people got married, I'd ask them, hey, you're about to change your life. Is there anything you'd like to tell me? Because right now we're on the same side of the river. You're going to cross over. Is there anything you want to tell me? And this sister was sufficiently older than me, and she was a pretty good friend, and she insisted that you'll know the right one when you meet her. Okay, now they've divorced since then. What theology do we have for them? All they went by was their feelings. The Almighty put this feeling on me, a very intense spiritual experience. Now, in these cases, many cases, their spirit was moved mightily, but all they had was an empty paper bag, and they had to find out the hard way. Yes, Yahweh brings people together, but they must decide for themselves what to do about it. That's number one. But in those fatal cases that I'm thinking of, that theater of activity, nearly every one of these cases had a simple doctrinal reason for falling apart. In some cases, there was no parental oversight. One reason I believe in courtship is because courtship is in the Bible. It's a big courtship. It's the courtship between Yahshua and his bride. And there's parental oversight there in a big way. In other cases, the people who got married were really not candidates for marriage. They really weren't supposed to be getting married. So we have these two theaters of activity. The feelings are similar. The promptings and the sensation is similar in their spirit. Some are successful, some are disastrous. And I can sort them out based on doctrine, a doctrinal basis. But there's a third case. What about those cases where they do obvious wrong in getting together and things appear to work out? Nothing bad happens. One fellow I know, he's been kicked out of the fellowship, but let me back up. This is before even YRM got started, and he was kicked out by the Brotherhood at large. And for those of you who are just getting acquainted with us, you look at the scriptures, putting out the evildoer is a sign of a healthy assembly. But this character insisted that he was a minister. In fact, he thought he didn't have to work. He wanted people to pay him tithes. And he pointed to the good behavior of his wife as evidence of his ministerial calling. Then all of a sudden, I was developing a friendship with this chap. This goes back almost two decades. And he started getting on the internet, and he made friends with a married lady in another country. And suddenly he started talking about following your heart. He traveled abroad, he met her, he came back and insisted this relationship is from heaven. That woman far away divorced her husband. This chap dumped his wife, and he insisted this new thing was from heaven. And when you bump into somebody like that who's so fervently convinced that they're doing the right thing, they almost can trick you. Their spirit is so strongly stirred in that direction. All we can do with characters like this is to put them out of the fellowship. But we cannot let them establish doctrine, especially doctrines about marriage. The cults do that. The cults have experiences and all kinds of crazy things go on if you study cults like I have. They establish new doctrines based on feelings and experiences. We're not going to dwell on this much longer. It's a stepping stone to understanding religious issues. But my experience, research, and observation, these spiritual experiences that precede courtship, betrothal, and marriage, they are not to be relied on. They're to be verified. Here's another experience that people point to, split-second timing. People are really impressed with split-second timing. I'm going to start with a beautifully good one, a delicious one. I'm not going to tell you more than the fact that his name is Tom, a beloved brother in the network. He's like one of these unordained ministers. He runs around serving people a lot. He serves as a kind of a post office for people around the country. Brother Tom just published a testimony on Facebook. See, there's an elderly man in Tom's community that he looks after and runs errands for. And Tom went to the post office one day. There was a mysterious shoebox there delivered to him, brand new pair of walking shoes. It wasn't his size. And the letter inside said, "Brother Tom, I don't know why, but Yahweh put it on my heart to send this to you." And Tom was mystified. He threw it in the car and just didn't give it any thought. But when he visited that elderly man again, he noticed by the door an old, beat-up, decrepit pair of walking shoes. And he looked. It was the same make and model and the same size as the pair in the box. It's out there for anybody to see on Facebook. But this is an example of Yahweh's participation in our work. And you'll find that when you get in the game and do Yahweh's work, doors open, things start happening when you're doing Yah's work. But does it establish doctrine? Does this mean now I have to send big checks to Tom? Tom's a nice guy. He would never interpret it that way. And given enough time, maybe I'd find there's things I disagree with Tom about. But I delight in that kind of heavenly provision. No collusion, no coordination, except from heaven. And then there's another guy running around the country. He insists that he's a minister, absolutely insists on it. He's on his third marriage. His current wife is on her fifth marriage. He insists that he's a minister. And I challenged him on this. I said, come on, the scriptures have qualifications for ministry. How could you, how could you overrule that? And he claimed that he and this lady thought about getting married at the same time, though they were separated by hundreds of miles. And this is the kind of thing I'm worried about. By the way, it might seem judgmental that I frame it up this way, but you know, I'd have to judge against their prior mates to accept this report. And I'm not comfortable judging against somebody's prior mate. We have people come to us with some very difficult stories, some real heartbreaks and tragedies. And let's get something clear. When somebody goes through a divorce, it's very, very painful. They are hurting. It turns out even people who instigate divorce are hurting, I found out. But for a man to say he's in official ministry, just because they thought about it at the same time, well, now that I know our spiritual life is part of our natural life, they connected. And over great miles, they thought about something at the same time. I don't take that as an omen to overthrow the scriptures. Now, he doesn't have to be ordained to serve. Anybody can serve. But to be in official ministry, it's very hard to accept that. Some people like to take split-second timing as a sign of Yahweh's endorsement. But if you look at the first chapter of Job, you'll find his servants come to his home with split-second timing, bing, 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 each of them announcing the calamities that befell Job's relatives. That whole scene was architected by Satan the devil. Split-second timing doesn't impress me. What does the Bible say? That's what I want to know. Spiritual experience, signs. This is one where I may get a lot of pushback, but I'm standing on Yahshua's words. He says, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks a sign. If you want to know how to discern Yahweh's will, it's in Romans 12, verse 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of Elohim, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto Elohim, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world. That's a big one. But be you transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of Elohim. Signs and fleeces. People come to me and try to impress me with their fleeces. I've never seen anybody get a sheepskin and put it out on a wet night and pray that it be dry the next morning. I've never seen anybody put out a dry fleece. But I've never seen anybody put out a fleece on a wet night and ask for it to be dry in the morning, and then the next day do the opposite. I've never seen that. What they usually do is they count the number of red lights on the way to work, or if I get a phone call between 12 and 1, and this is how they guide their life. The holy people trafficking in this, it bothers me sometimes. See, I think we've inherited this from the Christian world. We're supposed to discern Yahweh's will by transforming our mind and forsaking worldly attitudes and worldly approaches. Made friends with a guy with a congregation far from here because I love to network with Yah's people. The guy hardly knew me. He's a nice guy. He hardly knew me. He does not live with that assembly, but he says, you know, you ought to consider moving there. Oh, I said, really? I'm on the phone with him. He says, yeah, there's a lot of single women there. I said, brother, I don't think like that. It's not how I approach things. He says, hey, I'll tell you what, you ought to cast a fleece. The guy hardly knows me. He wants me to cast a fleece. Yahshua said, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks a sign. Now, some of you have cast fleeces, you've asked for signs, and then you followed where that pointed. I'm pointing you to a higher way, a higher path. I got a little bad news for those of you who run your life with signs and fleeces. You've made a vow when you did that, because you said to Yahweh, when I see this, I'm going to do that. And you can't get out of it. I don't want to run my life like that. I'd rather be renewed by the transforming of my mind to take on the mind of Messiah and discern his will like that. You notice when the apostles cast lots to pick the replacement for Judas, they had the lots for one of two men. They should have had a third choice, none of the above. They never did that. Let's press on. Growing list of spiritual experiences. Down near the bottom, I've added split-second timing, including coincidences, signs, and fleeces. These are all spiritual experiences. Do we use those to overrule Yah's word? Tell you the truth, I really can't get too involved in your life. If you want to run your life with signs and fleeces, I don't suppose there's a whole lot I can do about it. But if you use that to establish doctrine, if you urge others to follow that kind of path, Do you understand that you're taking on something the Almighty never really intended? What do we make of these things when you have these intense spiritual feelings, these intense experiences? And by the way, when people cast fleece and ask for signs, it's because they're troubled inside. They want an answer, and they want to get an answer outside of themselves. I understand the motive. But I'll give you two testimonies of myself. My new lust job. There was a new job I wanted. I lusted after it. Try to imagine a job where you're 100% qualified and there's nobody else in town who can do it. I interviewed for a chip design job in Chicago, and a microchip design job. And the lady said, "You can do the work, but I want you to use the computer tools that we have right now coming in the door." I remember when I interviewed with Bell Labs at that job fair, as soon as the guy heard I was a chip designer, he just said, "When can you start? When can you start?" He didn't ask any questions about, "Can you use my computer tools?" For some reason, this lady wanted me to use her computer tools. And I want you to know, friends, every time I talked to that lady, I felt a giant knot in my stomach. I felt like a ton of bricks was falling on top of me. I cried out to Yahweh to take those icky feelings away, and he did, at least twice. But every time I did a follow-up discussion with that lady, oh, I felt miserable. Does that mean I should have rejected the job just because I felt miserable? I didn't know what to do. I cried out, "Yahweh, make the decision for me. I don't know what to do." Well, the lady finally turned me down. I don't know. She's probably still looking for a guy to fill that job. But I found out a year later that the company, their paychecks were bouncing. And I was looking after my mother's health care. I couldn't afford to have paychecks bouncing. Yahweh revealed to me in my spirit something was wrong. And when I had no way of finding out, he took care of it for me. Turn the page. I supplemented my mother's health care by hiring a part-time aide. I had the money. I thought I should do it. I interviewed this lady. She seemed qualified. Everything lined up. But I had the same knot in my stomach with her that I had with that job interview. Should I have brushed her off? I felt sorry for her. She was a Polish lady who moved here from Europe. She seemed to need the job. My mother needed her help. Where did this knot in my stomach came from? I fasted for a day. And the icky feeling went away. Completely went away. So I hired her, and that lady proved to be the best thing that ever happened to my mom in her old age. But if I had just went with that feeling, that blessing would not have occurred. I think what happened in the spiritual realm is that someone just needed to fast and pray about her situation for a day. Because there was a deliverance there. So at the bottom of our growing list of spiritual experiences is icky feelings. Something doesn't feel right. What do we make of these things? I apologize for the misspelling there. So I put them in bold yellow letters for you. Strong feelings and profound experiences do not establish Yah's will, nor do they establish doctrine. These things are a call to investigate and prove them. That's all. Prove in Old English means to test severely. You pray for wisdom, and you ask that all pertinent facts be exposed. I think there's situations where we be afraid to ask for all the facts. Maybe because we don't want to ruin a good thing. What I'm about to impart to you is not in the notes, but it's something that's sort of known out there, is that if you have uncertain situations and you're very unsure, you could pray through Psalm 91 and ask Yahweh to make things plain. The only downside is sometimes you find out people who have been betraying you are exposed, or something you want very badly disintegrates before you. But prove really means to prove all things. And if you do that, I won't have a problem with it, no matter what your experience is. These intense feelings have got to be verified, one way or the other, up or down, left or right. Here's a transitional case. Storefront Church in Chicago. Now, the fellow who was the pastor there was in the faith for a while. He's now in a state penitentiary up north. He's not in the faith. He's turned Muslim. I've heard through the grapevine that when he gets out, he wants to kill me. Okay, this is the kind of case I'm talking about. But when he was in the faith, he told me this story. Prior to coming into the faith, him and his wife ran a storefront church. They were behind in bills and the phone was shut off. And he got in a situation one day where they had to use a phone. They had to make a red hot phone call. And they cried out to heaven, "Father, we need to make a phone call. What do we do? The phone is turned off." And all of a sudden the phone rang. And he picked it up. And a guy on the other end said, "Hi, I'm Joe Dokes. I'm the repairman on the telephone pole. Could you please confirm the address that you picked up this phone in?" They told him the address, and then they put down the phone. Him and his wife looked at each other and said, "Let's try it." Remember, they just prayed about this. They picked up the phone, and they dialed that red-hot phone call. They consummated the business, whatever it was, and they hung up the phone. They immediately picked it back up, and the line was dead. I'm happy their prayer was answered. Maybe you are too. I want prayers answered. I want nice things to happen to people. Psalm 107 indicates that Yahweh takes pleasure in delivering us from our calamities, even if they are self-inflicted. But there's a little problem here. That man actually wasn't married to that woman. They were never married. When they came into the fellowship, she left before I joined the fellowship. But they were never married. They ran a church and Yahweh answered their prayer. Does answered prayer establish truth? This is a question I have for you. The truth of the matter is that anyone can pray and get answers. Even pagans can pray and get answers. This is probably the greatest mystery for us to accept. As our prayers can be answered even though we're far from Yahweh's truth. Brother Terry, your sermon last week means more to me than you could ever know. I needed that message last week about prayer, and everything you said was key, important, and true. But those instructions in the Bible about prayer are for us, because even our prayers in the household of faith, in Yahshua's body, our prayers are governed by Yah's laws. Now, for people at large, their answers, when they get answers to their prayers, they come from Yahweh cutting them a break, because I have evidence that Yahweh's a nice guy. Or it might be Yahweh's will anyway. Sometimes there's demonic participation. And sometimes the fervor of their own faith and the strength of their own spirit affects things such that their prayers are answered. But for us, Yahweh tells us what to pray for and how to pray. You know, if these verses I'm going to cite are foreign to you, you're not reading your Bible. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they prosper, they love thee. Pray that your flight not be in the Sabbath of the winter. Pray for your enemies. Pray for all men, leaders, magistrates, and so forth. There's so many things to pray for. But there's also cases where he tells us to not pray. There are times when I've prayed and I couldn't gin up the faith. It's as though Yahweh put a knife to my throat. He told Jeremiah, "Don't you pray for these people." Answered prayer does not establish truth. Answered prayer is a gift from heaven, but it doesn't establish doctrine, truth. Here's another spiritual experience, a complicated series of events. A lady on the internet wrote a blog about a complicated series of events that taught her to believe in the lunar Sabbath theory. We have a booklet explaining why the lunar Sabbath theory is wrong. I call it the Loony Sabbath delusion. And I posted up a calculation showing her the math. I said, "Sister, there's two formulas for establishing Pentecost, and both formulas get you the same date on the calendar. But the lunar Sabbath system warps, twists, and distorts those two formulas." And I showed that. It was so simple. And she wrote back and she said, "I can't help what the Almighty has shown me." Again, personal experience, an impressive, complicated series of events got her to this belief. Nothing else matters in that case to her. I want to know what the scriptures say. Once you understand that our spiritual side is just as natural as our physical side, you're not as impressed with these things anymore. Let's talk about the spiritual trifecta of error, the Happy Christian Seminar. I'd like you to think about this. I've been to Happy Christian Seminars, and so have you. Come on, so many of us have profited from them, learned from them. But there is a spiritual trifecta of error there. I'd like you to think about this. Everything profitable in those seminars, and believe me, I've enjoyed them. Everything, though, that's profitable there comes from the Bible. And Yahweh promises his word will prosper. It's from Isaiah 55, verse 10 to 11, and I'm only going to read the part that I underline here. So shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth, it shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please. By the way, the verses right after this is the song, You Shall Go Out with Joy, the Trees of the Field. Yahweh's word bears fruit wherever it goes. That's a fact of life. And I'm glad he did it that way, because he doesn't require us to be perfect in all ways in order to benefit from his great book. When you go to the Happy Christian Seminar and you are blessed or you feel euphoric, it's his word that prospered you. Let's look at pitfall number one. They blend truth with error, and they slip it in on you. I'll give you some examples. They might say, when my grandmother died and went to heaven last year, or they'll say, we were at the Christmas gathering last December. One guy with Bill Gothard's Embassy Institute. I mean, there's some really fine teachings there. But the guy cracked a joke about the unclean food laws. He said, I made some pork chops for that barbecue for the brethren, and I don't think I cooked them enough. I thought we were going to be punished for breaking that law. He made a joke about it. They slip that stuff in there like it's okay. If you were a pastor, and I know there's some ministers who watch these broadcasts, if you were a minister, would you stop the presentation and correct it on the fly and say, hold on, the Bible doesn't support that remark. The Bible doesn't support that. Would you stop it? Would you be afraid to stop it and correct it on the fly because you didn't want to disrupt things? There is a saying in the fellowship, I'll chew the meat and spit out the bones. Question, why would you put bones in your mouth? This is really starting to bother me. When people put these seminars together, where did they get the information? They got it the same place everybody else got it, from the Bible. Pitfall number two, they charge money. Charging money is a marketing trick. Yahshua knew about it too. Marketing science says you make people pay for something, they'll appreciate it. Yahshua knew about it. He said, where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be. The same guy who told us where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be, he disallowed charging of money for religious instruction. When he sent the apostles out on the missionary tour, he said, heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely you have received, freely you give. And he based that on Proverbs 23:23. Buy the truth and sell it not, also wisdom and instruction and understanding. You're not supposed to put a price tag on the truth. Well, there's a good reason for that. The spiritual transaction between you and your Father in heaven must be a pure spiritual transaction, and you don't want it manipulated or influenced by some marketing trick. Make them pay for it. They'll appreciate it. I want a congregation full of people who appreciated the truth on the basis of its own value, on the basis of their own relationship with heaven, not because, well, I already paid money for it. I might as well, you know, go on with it. I want no manipulation of people's spirit. That's pitfall number two. They charge a lot of dough for some of these seminars. People come from far away and are really impressed by this. Pitfall number three, they don't want to hear you. If the guy teaches error, you have no occasion to go up there and correct him. Remember, they're blending truth with error. Why should they hear you? You gave them money. Why should they hear you? A tragedy. There's a minister I know who was the best equipped minister I've ever known in my life. In terms of always dealing in his life, his connections with the scriptures, his training, the best equipped pastor I ever knew. He went to one of these Happy Christian Seminars for ministers, and he told me he felt something in the room. And I'd rather just close the curtain and not think about it. But from that time forward, he started to dismantle the Hebrew roots of the faith. Toward the end of my time going there, I think three times I saw pork served on the fellowship food bar. Just totally tearing everything down. He was at the point where he was defending Christmas. You know? And downplaying the feast. Oh my gosh. It was so hard. Because he went to a happy Christian seminar and he felt something in the room. If there was anything profitable there, it came from Yahweh's word. But people have these experiences that they think, oh, it's a snapshot endorsement of everything in the room. Here's how I reply to this, because these seminars do profit people. There's some good that comes out of them for sure. Here's how I think it should be. If there is a need amongst us men, for example, among the men should be called together and get real with Yahweh. They're building that new building over there. Now, maybe there's a room in there where we could meet. If we have a need amongst us, I don't know, the usual topics, relationships, financial freedom, you know, any of that stuff. The men should be able to go in that room, get on their knees, get their Bibles open, and get real with each other, and get real with Yahweh. Nobody's ringing the cash register. Everything's us and Yahweh. We can get answers too, and we don't have to set up these big seminars. It is written, they shall all be taught of Yahweh. That's what I want. State of the dead doctrines. We're going to wind down with this kind of stuff. The first lie told to man came through a serpent. If you look at the Hebrew, the construct is very simple. Yahweh tells Adam, in dying you will die. But in the serpent's words to the lady, our mother, he says, in dying you will not die. So many doctrines have wiggle room. This one has none. There's that Hebrew construct, lo, means not. Yahweh says, dying, you will die. The serpent says, dying, you will not die. One of these two characters is telling a lie. Of course, it's the serpent. The first lie told the men. The devil has a lot invested in this lie. You know how it is. I've told lies. I had to cover them up with a lot more lies. You all know what this is like. The enemy has to pile on more and more lies to keep that lie going. And dying, you will not die. If you take popular beliefs in aggregate, they convey a false sense of security in death. Popular culture conveys the idea that, oh yeah, everybody lives after they die. Oh yeah, the afterlife. Everybody gets that. But if you lay those all end to end on a stage, they don't add up. Seances, Ouija boards, I purposely misspelled that, by the way. Magazine covers, dreams, out-of-body experiences, pagan doctrines, near-death experiences, and many more things. If you look at just one of them, you say, yeah, I guess we do live after we die. People talking to dead relatives and that. Apparitions. But if you were to lay them side by side, you find that their content does not match. That's a tip off right there. Some of you are going to resist this. You're going to believe in your heart, no, I had this experience. This is the first lie told to man. I should tell you that in this world of psychic research, there's a quadrant in that realm. And let me back up. In my youth, I used to be in the occult. That doesn't make me an expert, but it means I know more than most. In the world of psychic research, there's a sector of them that approach it very scientifically. And among them, it's well known that talking to the dead is one of the most dangerous things you could ever do. And these people who get mixed up in this, they think, oh, that had to be Uncle Louie. Only Uncle Louie knew the combination to the safe. But when someone starts talking to the dead, that spirit gets in their brain and they can't get rid of it. Then they find out it wasn't Uncle Louie. It was another one of the demons pretending to be Uncle Louie. Then there's that presence feeling of dead relatives. I guess I'd call that a spiritual experience too. And when when my father passed away, I had a dream that I encountered him at a gate in a yard. And I said to him, Dad, I miss you. He looked back at me and he said, I miss you too. And I woke up and I felt really good. It felt really soothing inside. And I said, wait a minute. This can be addicting. This feels too good. I could see where a pagan or somebody who doesn't know otherwise would draw strength from that. I made up my mind that if he ever talked to me again in a dream, I'd rebuke him. And shortly after that, it happened. I met him on a bridge in a dream. It's funny how I remember this in a dream. I said, "You're not my father. In the name of Yahshua the Messiah, get out of here." And he never came back again. It's very addicting to talk to the dead. It feels good. I don't know if I'll ever see my father, you know, in eternity. But talking to the dead is very dangerous. It's forbidden by the Torah. It's confirmed by scientific research in the psychic community. You don't want to talk to the dead. Those who argue about the seance between Saul and Samuel and that witch doctor lady, people who point to that argue about that. They say, well, it says it was the spirit of Samuel. How could it be? And those who argue about that miss the point. The point is, when someone goes in that realm, it's confusing. You get a blend of truth and error. Another time after my dear mother passed away, I was sitting in the kitchen and I knew she was standing in the backyard. This is all baloney. This is my mind playing tricks with me. My spirit playing tricks with me. I can see where pagans take those feelings and derive doctrines from them. Oh, I nixed that off too. It wasn't my mother out there. Now, I still have dreams sometimes that my parents are alive, but it's always like they're in another room or something like that. But I can't let those experiences give me the expectation that I've made contact with them. Let's talk about near-death experiences. These are getting real popular because modern science can rescue people from death at the last minute. Now, in the Western world, NDEs, near-death experiences, typically involve a light, a tunnel, and smiling relatives on the other side. And typically the smiling relatives on the other side say, listen, it's too soon, go back. And so people come back from that and they say, hey, I know there's something out there. As I saw my relatives on the other side of this light. Now in the East, Hindu near-death experiences, they sometimes see the light and tunnel. And one thing that's very prominent in their experience is that when they have a near-death experience, they encounter an angry God. I don't use the word G-O-D in reference to my Father in heaven, but they encounter some angry God who tells them to go back because it's too soon. And some of these stories are very funny. One guy reports these two angels brought him to this angry God, and he's yelling at the angels, get out of here! He tells the guy, go back, it's too soon to die. You know, it's evident upon closer research that near-death experiences are actually a playbook reflecting what your culture is telling you. By the way, the Muslims teach, like we do, that when you're dead, you surely die. And it's actually near-death experiences are very rare amongst Muslims, believe it or not. But in some Western cases, people in near-death experiences, they see former pets over there. Yeah, they experience something. I like the words of C.S. Lewis. This stuff is real, but a real what? Oh yeah, Uncle Charlie's horse was over there. And you wake up from a near-death experience with a Charlie horse? Okay. All right, I thought I'd try it. Near-death experience is no basis for establishing doctrine. I think it's a natural experience, to tell you the truth. The research is still young on this, but it looks like the brain is being bombarded with endorphins. It feels great. And Elder Alan Mansegger, I think he put it well on one of the broadcasts. He said, it looks like Yahweh made it so that if you die a natural death, now it makes it so it's a pleasant experience. There was one other side of this thing, though. Oh, yes, my Uncle George, my dear Uncle George. George was a tough guy. You know, but after his near-death experience, he still cussed, you know, like a sailor. No put down on the sailors now. And then he went and prayed the rosary more. I mean, to me, this is not the outcomes we want if somebody experienced the truth in a near-death experience. And if someone in the sound of my voice had a near-death experience, it's fine, you know, fine, but it's just a natural thing. And what you receive there is no different than these dreams, a playbook of what you've been taught to that point. This may be the most difficult. But remember, I was in the occult in my youth. I spent a lot of my time in my youth trying to do an out-of-body experience. Turns out this appears to be a natural phenomena that can happen on occasion to people. People have a feeling that they're existing outside of their own body. I mean, we've had some people in the fellowship who've had this happen. Now, there are a small number of cases in the Bible that may have been like this, and I'll show you this in a moment. But scientific studies have been inconclusive on this. Sometimes these people report accurately seeing something far away when they went there, and sometimes they are in error. They do not accurately report something that's in the very room where they claim to have floated around. I claim because it's something in their spirit, it's prone to error. I want to put a warning out to you. I tried very hard to have an out-of-body experience in my youth. I bought a, hate even to think about it. I bought books on it, and I tried very hard to make it happen. I want to put you on alert. If you pull a stunt like that, you will leave yourself vulnerable to demonic activity. Don't make me go into the details. You don't want to monkey around with that. In 2 Corinthians 12, Paul reports, he reports somebody who had an experience, and he's saying that if he's going to boast, he's going to boast in his infirmities. He'll boast about somebody else's spiritual experiences, but not his own. We're almost done here. It is not profitable for me, doubtless, to boast. I will come to visions and revelations of Yahweh. I knew a man in the Messiah above 14 years ago. Whether in the body, I cannot tell, or whether out of the body, I cannot tell. Elohim knoweth, such an one caught up into the third heaven. And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell. Elohim knoweth, how that he was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Of such an one I will boast, yet of myself I will not boast except in mine infirmities. Paul experienced a lot of pain in his life, a lot of infirmity, and he felt that these were sent to him by Yahweh to conform him to Yahshua's image. But he inadvertently mentions this guy. He says, I don't know if it was in his body or out. But it rhymes with some of the things people have reported to happen to them naturally. Now, there's two other cases where we can't be sure. How did Isaiah's vision play out? How did that occur? When John the Apostle experienced the Revelation book, all those things, how did that work? Was his body down here, his mind up there? We don't have all the facts. But is this proof that one can live after they die? This is the thing I'm worried about. I must say, if you've ever had an out-of-body experience, don't come running to me to make a doctrine out of it or trying to impress me. Paul is telling you you're better off rejoicing in your infirmities because Yahweh's using that to conform you to Yahshua's image. It turns out that when people have a near-death experience or an out-of-body experience, they all come back. It's not proof that they live after they die. And many of them come back and report a silver cord connecting them back to reality, often coming out of their very back. Now, I'm not going to read all this passage from Ecclesiastes 12. I've talked about this before, and others have too. Ecclesiastes 12, the first six verses, talk about the process of aging and dying. I'm going to focus on the underlying parts. When the sound of the grinding is low, that's when people are chewing without their teeth. And he shall rise up at the voice of a bird. In other words, sleep is elusive. The daughters of the music shall be brought low. He's hard of hearing. And they shall be afraid of that which is high. In other words, they don't like climbing high steps. This is the process of aging. And fear shall be in the way. And the almond tree shall flourish. In other words, the almond tree looks kind of white from a distance, and it's compared to the white head of wisdom. And the grasshopper shall be a burden. In other words, everything's an aggravation. And desire shall fail because man goeth through his long home, and the mourners go about in the streets. Note this, or ever the silver cord be loosed. I read recently that Ecclesiastes is evidence that Solomon repented at the end of his life. And I read between the lines of Ecclesiastes, I see a broken man. I see a very damaged man. A very sobering book filled with wisdom that we don't have to pay for. But he mentions the silver cord. It's been very hard to tie that into any aspect of dying or death, except that when people have this experience, they have a cord coming out of their back. Not everybody sees it. But what I think is going on is that when people have this, there's some kind of a malfunction going on there between their body and their spirit. And nobody's ever had the silver cord and come back. Therefore, I do not take these out-of-body experiences as evidence that you can live forever. I don't. And I don't want you to either. We're going to have to confront these things as to what they are. It is possible that this is just demonic activity. I'm not ready to make that claim yet. But it's no reason for us to overthrow the stern warnings of Scripture. The soul that sinneth shall die. And in dying you shall die. Let's recap the partial list of spiritual experiences here. Hunches, premonitions. Sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. Aha moments. I've had a lot of aha moments when I do construction work around the house. Aha, I think I know the tool I need. Aha, I know the screw that'll work. And I find out it's the wrong thing. It's the wrong glue. At the aha moment, I think the Almighty talked to me. Sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. Dreams, suspicion, intense feelings, love, jealousy, split-second timing and coincidences, signs and fleeces. You know, to an outsider, it might look like we're running our life like a casino. You know, at a casino, they're all playing their hunches. Euphoria, ecstasy, icky feelings, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, or the presence feeling of dead relatives. Our spirit is vulnerable, prone to error. It is not the source of truth. If you feel something strongly in your spirit, use it as a basis for further research. The spiritual life, do you really want results? Come on, do you really want results? Instead of watching for UFOs, where they're just a bunch of jokers from outer space, they're demons, that's all they are. Instead of keeping track of UFOs, focusing on demons, collecting stories of dead communicating with us, keeping track of your dreams or following your heart. Let's think about the people in the Bible who got results. Yahshua, fasting and praying 40 days, he got results. Moses, fasting and praying 40 days, he got results. Cornelius, fasting, prayer, and alms. The angel told him, what you've done is a memorial. There's only like 5 memorials in the whole Bible. Yahweh's name, Sabbath, Passover. Yahweh's telling us something here with guys like Cornelius, fasting, prayer, and alms. If you have a profound experience, I urge you to test it, like the noble Bereans. Let's follow the example of the great champions of the Bible. And then we're going to start to see some great things happen, and we won't have to do any apologizing for it. You've been real patient with me. May Yahweh bless you and speak to you.